Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
As I'm sure you all know, Matt is one of my biggest cheerleaders on Queen Street. Hello, a free Prime Minister needs one. An influential commentator who can bend a sympathetic ear and give a voice to your cause. Matt Millen had buildings. Thatcher had Woodrow Wyatt. I have Matt Chalk. So devoted is he to my interests. He gets up at 5:30 each morning to post a Theresa May fan sheet he calls Red Box.
I'm sorry to report that the delusion in number 10 is even worse than we thought. That was the Prime Minister at last week's Westminster Correspondents' Dinner. This is the Red Box Politics podcast from The Times. I'm Matt Chorley. As suspected, last week's episode divided the audience, especially on the merits of children's films in general and Black Panther in particular. Benbo12 writes on iTunes, "Love the podcast, but do we have to have David Aronovich moaning about the cost of sash windows and trying to impose his cultural tastes on people?" Well, no, not this week we don't. Instead, I'm joined by Times columnist Rachel Sylvester, who says the left is eating itself. Comedian Matt Ford has fallen out of love with PMQs. But first, we lift the Brexit embargo on the podcast to be joined by Times political correspondent Henry Zeffman, who will tell us what we really need to know and what we don't.
This is still in the world of cakeism, a diplomatic source told The Times after Theresa May's big Brexit speech last Friday. But forget stale culinary metaphors. The Prime Minister did something important at Mansion House. She accepted for the first time that her red lines of pulling the UK out of the single market and out of the customs union will result in reduced cooperation, whatever deal is agreed. Honesty or otherwise, the question is whether enough of her party will be happy with that come the end of the year.
Now, I mean, there's always a slight suspicion when the Prime Minister is speaking that we're not learning anything new, but this was a genuinely new development in the government's thinking about Brexit. This admission that when David Davis said we were going to enjoy all the benefits that we had before, that might not necessarily be what you might call true.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want to go too far and suggest that the whole speech was a cornucopia of new revelations from Theresa May. And this is one nugget in a speech which, I mean, the opening passage of the speech, she basically recapped the first speech she ever gave as Prime Minister. But yes, this particular element was Theresa May's attempt to firstly, be frank with the Conservative Party. Secondly, be frank with the country. But I think most importantly, be seen by Europe to be being frank and being reasonable about what Brexit means. Now, the complication with all of this is that we all know that Theresa May knows that Brexit in any form will result in less cooperation, particularly less economic cooperation with the EU, because she supported Remain in the EU referendum. And that was one of the reasons that she gave for that. But this was her attempt to basically move the debate on. She said to the EU, we can't have all the obligations but none of the rights, which was her way of saying to the EU, you can't expect us to behave as if things are the same, but also saying to the UK, we can't behave as if things are going to be the same. We are going to have more limited access, but we're going to do some things differently. That was her attempt at the upside.
Rachel, you've written about this in your column in the Times this week, and you point out we are in a slightly strange position of having a government and a prime minister implementing something which deep down they probably don't think is a terribly good idea.
I think it's really fascinating. You've got a prime minister who's doing something that she thinks is going to make the country poorer and less safe and is ultimately not in the national interest, but she feels it's her duty to do it. And the same, the Chancellor and the Home Secretary both voted for Remain, and they're now having to implement a Brexit that I think in their hearts of hearts they don't really think is the right thing to do in terms of the economics or the security. There's a separate issue about whether the referendum result has to be honoured, which I think to some extent it does, but the problem is they're caught between different definitions of what's the right thing to do. And especially for Theresa May, who's this kind of dutiful vicar's daughter, desperate to do the moral thing, I think you can see it in her eyes, in her awkward smile. She doesn't really know, she doesn't really feel committed to this absolutely monumental change she's forcing through and leading the country to. You saw it last week after the speech. She was asked by a German journalist, do you think it's going to be worth it? Is Brexit going to be worth it? And she couldn't say yes. She said, well, you know, the British people voted for it and it's the duty of politicians to implement
it. Not
my fault,
Gov.
I know. Yeah. And I just think there's a... I've spoken to several ministers who say, look, we know this isn't in the national interest, but what else can we do? If we don't do it, we'll split the Tory party and also the voters will get cross. But I think there's now, really fascinatingly talking to people yesterday, I think there's a growing feeling on the backbenches, but also among some ministers, that maybe there needs to be some space created by extending the process of Article 50 or somehow give a time for a genuinely meaningful vote to happen on what Brexit means, and also possibly whether you could have another referendum or a referendum on the final deal, so that people can look at the real actual reality of Brexit and say, do we want this or do we actually want to stay where we are?
Matt, it is a slightly odd situation. Normally when, you know, prime ministers have done controversial and unpopular things before, but normally they thought at the time it was the right thing to do.
As a playwright, I've got no idea what you're on about.
But Tony Blair, when he made the decision to invade Iraq, thought that that was a good idea.
Absolutely,
and it was the right thing to do. And would still argue, still does now argue in slightly contorted ways that deep down it was the right thing to do. But to have the person in the middle of it right now not totally convinced of the right thing to do is a bit weird.
There's a perversion about it, and it actually, I think, makes me question what a politician's for. What is actually the role of a politician? Is a politician there simply to enact the will of the people, or is a politician there to sometimes change people's minds? And obviously, at various points, it's a mixture of both, or it's one more than the other. But there is something bizarre about a prime minister delivering something, the biggest decision in our country's, you know, since the Second World War, that they disagree with. And this whole point of a second referendum, I voted for Remain, and I think Brexit's a disaster. But I think if you were to rerun the referendum tomorrow, we'd probably lose it again, which is why I think that crucial distinction of having a vote on the final deal actually is a more winnable referendum for those of us on the Remain side who think it's a disaster, and most of the evidence suggests that it is.
But what happens then? So you have a vote on a deal. Say the deal is rejected. What happens then?
Well, that's it. At least then you at least buy yourself some time.
Yeah.
You at least then have some sort of
this means more talking about
you have at least
Brexit.
A mandate for a pause or for something else. You at least then are adding to the doubt around the whole thing. Equally, having a second referendum or another referendum or however you frame it isn't risk-free, not just in terms of the outcome, but in terms of public response to it. And I think it's very easy for us, for those of us that are obsessed with politics, to often take the emotion out of it and just say, well, look, it's going to be a mistake, so why don't we change our mind? People feel very differently out there, and there are parts of Britain that are still miles behind London. I mean, parts of London that are miles behind other parts of London. There is a genuine anger out there that if you offend or if you don't handle that effectively, you will have civil unrest. You will have that on the street. So us Remainers shouldn't pretend that this is all very simple and you just have another referendum, we win it, and then this, you know, this U-turn happens and everything's fine. It's frankly a bit of a disaster whatever happens now.
I think we dramatically overstate the enthusiasm to talk about Brexit on both sides of the argument. I mean, when I spent most of the general election on the campaign trail, following various candidates around, and I was very struck in all different parts of the country, be it Vauxhall, where the Lib Dems were trying to sort of lead a Remain charge against Kate Hoey, or Middlesbrough, where the Tories were trying to take traditional Labour voters who'd voted for Brexit. no one cared. I mean, this was basically a year on from the referendum. We're now getting on for 2 years on from the referendum. And you'd ask people about Brexit and they'd basically say, oh, yeah, we did that last year. So yeah. I think any sort of argument for a second referendum, which is based on the idea that developments which have happened in Westminster since the first referendum have clarified or muddied or whatever that has militated the arguments for a second referendum, I think just fails a basic interest test. I mean, the second point I just make, I totally agree with Rachel. I mean, it's palpable that Theresa May doesn't believe or doesn't believe this to the extent which you'd hope a prime minister does when they're enacting the biggest constitutional shake-up in however long. I just think the answer, funnily enough, was there in July 2016, and as mad as this sounds, it was Andrea Leadsom. The Tory MPs who said that they needed a Brexiter to be Prime Minister were scoffed at the time because Theresa May was the grown-up in the race, but they were right. It is ludicrous to have a Prime Minister who talks the language of a pretty narrow subset of Tory MPs, because it was a pretty narrow subset of Tory MPs, Bill Cash and whoever, who've been ploughing this furrow for years, decades, who talks that language, but in their head knows it's nonsense. Whereas at least if you had someone who believed it, people could sort of call them nonsense in, call out their nonsense in a sort of honest way.
So it's all your fault, Rachel. If only, this happens every time you come on. You end up being reminded of your morning in a Costa Coffee in Milton Keynes, where you grilled Andrea Leadsom. I mean, whether or not it is Andrea Leadsom, there does seem to be this feeling that if we had a Prime Minister who did believe in it, I mean, quite apart from just being a bit more upbeat about it and saying, you know, when Boris Johnson tried this a couple of weeks ago in his policy exchange speech, and the slight problem is that half the country is completely turned off from listening to Boris Johnson, but his message of there are positives to this just isn't being made enough.
I actually want a Prime Minister who puts the national interest first, not the party interest or their own career or ambition or whatever, that actually thinks what is right for the country. And let's look at the facts. The government's had its economic analysis. You know, that's dismissed by experts, by the purists on the Brexit side. But I think you can't ignore it. And I thought that was why the intervention by John Major and Tony Blair in what looked like a coordinated set of speeches last week was so interesting, because there was sort of these former prime ministers have a role as almost like father of the nation, and with an objectivity, they're not tied into the tribalism of the day-to-day politics. And they were able to say, I thought John Major put it very well, he said, yes, of course, the will of the people has to be respected, but on the other hand, Parliament also has to protect the well-being of the people. And actually, whether or not people are bored by it or whatever, I'm sure is true now, but they're going to be pretty fed up if in 10 years' time, you know, there are fewer jobs around, they're feeling poorer, inequality's gone up, because no doubt the city and the super rich will carry on getting richer. And Brexit has had all these dire consequences. So
The most likely outcome is probably that nothing dramatic happens and we just never really know what would have happened
in this parallel universe. There is a problem, though. You're right. I think Henry's right in that the Theresa May is now in the sort of halfway house. It's like the Schrodinger's Brexit. It's sort of both dead and alive at the same time, where she's trying to pretend she's doing it, but actually trying to minimise absolutely everything. So you're not going to get the potential benefits.
Yeah, you end up with neither.
Nor are you having the protections of staying in. So it's a kind of halfway house, which is the worst of all worlds.
Just to bring it back to the speech, I mean, she basically made this explicit. I mean, the whole speech, 7,000 words, was a sort of contorted way of arguing for the softest Brexit possible within the very hard parameters which she maybe accidentally set out. Which she might not have appreciated the full consequences of when she set them out in her first party conference speech as leader. So a really good example of this, and apologies, I know that the Red Box podcast is meant to be a safe space, but I'm going to use the word divergence, which actually isn't a word that Theresa May used in her speech, because even she knows that it's not something that the kind of limited pool of people who will have watched that speech live want to hear. But she made the point that as long as she is Prime Minister, the government will not, in pretty much every area, diverge from EU regulations. That means British laws and specifically regulations covering all sorts of important sectors for the economy will be the same as the EU's. But she then admitted that she could not bind future governments, future prime ministers, I think she said future parliaments, hands. So basically she said to the EU, here's my assurance, we're going to be good, well-behaved, basically rule takers, Norway-style rule takers, for as long as I'm prime minister. You know, with a sort of quiet subtext that no prime minister after me will be mad enough to diverge. But for the EU to believe that British governments will just follow Theresa May's assurance for decades, I mean, how many times have they been burned by British politics in the last few years? I mean, it would be mad for the EU to simply take Theresa May's assurance. I mean,
and also, I don't understand how that's supposed to be taking back control, because presumably we're losing sovereignty, because meanwhile the EU is going to change those rules, sure, and we're going to have to keep shadowing and mirroring, but without having any say.
But we're going to have the power status, not to shadow or mirror.
We have a sovereign power to decide to copy.
We have the power to shoot ourselves in the foot. It isn't really power.
Just before we move on, Henry, as you're here and you're the one of the co-authors of the hugely popular Brexit briefing email at the Times does, just talk us through very quickly what are the key points, the dates? When can we tune in and out of Brexit to sort of pay attention to what's going on?
OK, so weirdly, though Theresa May was talking about the future relationship, the future trade deal this week, this month is actually all about transition. So the key thing that the UK and the EU need to sign up to in a fortnight, there's a European Council summit, March 22nd, March 23rd, is the terms of the UK's roughly two-year transitional phase, or implementation period, as the government likes to call it. Then after that, we enter into a period of negotiations on trade. At some point later this week, maybe next week, the EU is going to set out its detailed negotiating position on a trade agreement. So that's basically their response to Theresa May's speech, or their equivalent of Theresa May's speech. And then you have until October for them to come to some sort of accommodation. That's Michel Barnier's deadline for a withdrawal treaty to be agreed. Now, you think we all agreed that last December? No. Remember, Northern Ireland was fudged. Is this clear? Northern Ireland was fudged because the British government says that Northern Ireland can only be solved taking into account what they negotiate over the future trade agreement. So though those talks will rumble on into the transition, October is the key deadline when we'll basically know, does the UK have something it can put before the Commons? And then there's the separate and entirely vexed in and of itself question about what the Commons will do and the Lords will do. And does the EU have something it can put before the European Parliament? So
a couple more weeks and then we can tune out till October.
Tune out, except for on Thursday early afternoons when the Times Brexit briefing lands.
And you can, Times subscribers can sign up to that. You go to home.thetimes.co.uk/mynews. That's home.thetimes.co.uk/mynews, where you can click and subscribe to both the Brexit briefing and Red Box. All plugs there. Right, let's move on. I assume we'll have to come back to Brexit at some point, but let's move on. This is Rachel Sylvester.
The election for the Labour General Secretary shows the left-wing takeover of the party is complete. It's unite versus momentum, with not a moderate anywhere to be seen. The bitterness of the fight shows the factions are turning on each other. It's the narcissism of small differences as the left eats itself and the voters are ignored.
Now, wait, if we thought Brexit was complicated, trying to get your head around the internal factions of the Labour Party is quite something. I thought the unite and momentum were all on the same side.
Well, I know.
It's the Corbynistas versus Corbynistas.
It is. And that's what's so fascinating. So it's sort of a bit like Monty Python, People's Popular Front of Judea, whatever it is, versus the Popular Front of the People's Judea. And it's there are these different factions. And it's partly the difference between Unite, a trade union top-down organisation represented by Jenny Formby. I'm not going to bore you with too many names and details. But versus John Landsman, the leader of Momentum, which is the grassroots popular, you know, on the ground movement.
And so this was the group, this was the sort of grassroots separate group which basically propelled Jeremy Corbyn to being Labour leader.
So if you think of it as sort of top-down left-wingers versus grassroots left-wingers, and within that, it's a bit like there was, you know, everyone thought there were huge rows between Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. In fact, they were dancing on the head of the pin, really, when you compare, say, the difference between either of them and Jeremy Corbyn on the economy and tax and spending and foreign policy, actually. So there's a kind of...
And actually, although they try to dress up sometimes it as policy differences, a lot of it's personality and ego, and that's slightly what we're seeing in, you know, who does control the new left of the Labour Party.
But is I it think the unions or there is a difference of approach about, is it about sort of local democracy, if you like, with the momentum, and that they are very in favour of mandatory reselection of MPs, so that local parties can vote who they want as their candidate? Or is it the big trade union bloc vote approach, which is a more, you know, mechanical, if you like, it's sort of top down. But also I think within that there's a sort of bitterness of the fight is really revealing. And I think on the left there's a means justify the ends justify the means aspect to it that unleashes these forces of hell, of nastiness and bitterness. You saw it in the attacks on Claire Cober, the leader of Haringey Council. I interviewed her recently, and she was talking about how some of these momentum activists were standing in the public gallery during council meetings, singing the police song "Every Breath You Take," which is about stalking. So they were saying, "We're going to come and get you if you don't resign." And it was just appalling, misogynistic bullying, actually. So it's also the idea that there's total domination of the left now. So there's no moderate candidate who would think of standing for this, or even want to, or have a chance of winning. So the left have taken over the NEC, the shadow cabinet, the leadership. The only place, and a lot of councils, the only place where they don't dominate is in the actual parliamentary Labour Party, because most of the MPs are on the other side of the argument.
What do you make of this, Matt? A Labour leader seizing control of the machine and then forcing out all dissenters? It would never have happened in your day, would it?
Well, I mean, there's always a bit of this. So, you know, moderates or Blairites or whatever you want to call us can't pretend that when Tony Blair became leader, he didn't bring in people that he wanted and that people fell out of favour. That happens in politics, and I think in a way it should, to an extent. But I can't ever remember, even when I worked for the party, a competition for the General Secretary's job being played out like this. You know, usually it was just done behind closed doors. It was quite private. There was usually a union candidate. There was someone the leadership wanted, and often there'd be a compromise. But you've got Labour MPs campaigning for who they want to win this. You've got people out there saying that this should be elected by the party membership. I think a lot of people don't appreciate what the role of the General Secretary is. Part of the problem with the factionalism is whenever you have a court, left or right or centre, people want power in reward for their loyalty. Unite, make a compelling case that they effectively fund the Labour Party, have done for a long time. They have a lot of constitutional power. They feel that they should have a large say. Momentum, and they fascinate Momentum because they are a grassroots movement, but actually there is still basically a loyalty to the centre of that organisation, that when Momentum says vote this way, its members do exactly what it says. So it might be grassroots, but it is still a well-drilled machine. And you saw that in terms of the NEC elections, and you see it in the way that they behave on other campaigns. They send a message out and it is accepted with complete loyalty. And this is part of the problem, is that a lot of the good stuff that's come out of Momentum and out of Corbyn is that it's got people into politics, it's informing a lot of people. But when people are informed purely through factionalism, when people choose opinion first and then fact second, I fear that all you're doing actually is reinforcing a lot of ignorance. So people might feel that they're a little bit more informed about politics now, but actually they're not listening to the other side. They're not engaging with other ideas. And in the end, there is a price to be paid for that. And I think the price in the end is actually the public aren't tuning into any of this stuff at the moment. Do they tune in if Corbyn becomes Prime Minister and then it becomes more pertinent? Or do the public start giving more of a shit about this stuff prior to a general election and it actually starts to hurt the Labour Party?
I mean, just one point on this. I do think we're perhaps overstating the extent to which this split is new. There's always been a split on the left, the hard left, the far left of the Labour Party, between sort of radical Democrats, as they would see it, Bennites, as you might want to call them, and John Landsman is avowedly a Bennite, learned his politics from Tony Benn, and sort of hard left centralists. Which, you know, perhaps has more to do with the traditions of some other countries. And I think what's new here is just that it matters for the first time. You know, when John Landsman and Jenny Formby were both in the wilderness, although, as Matt points out, Unite's funded the Labour Party for a long time, so Unite has long been a bit more influential. But when this wing of the Labour Party was irrelevant, it was doubly irrelevant what splits they had amongst them. But now that they run the Labour Party, it does matter. I mean, it's basically a sign, as Rachel said, of how the left's takeover of the Labour Party is complete. And I think whichever candidate wins, and it's probably going to be Jenny Formby, irreversible. Because we are now in a position where, and these aren't necessarily small differences, but the differences in approach between different parts of the far left are what we are discussing in the context of differences of approach in the Labour Party, and that's really what this means.
There's one other really interesting thing, I think, is that Momentum is a really complicated mixture of idealistic young people who are attracted to a sort of new, what they feel is a new sort of politics and the possibility of real change, so more equality, more kind of power to people, and then there's alongside that there's these kind of old Bennite organisers who are much more in the kind of old-fashioned top-down nasty politics mould, with quite a lot of misogyny and anti-Semitism thrown in there, actually. And it's that some people characterise it as sort of John Lennon singing Imagine versus the Leninists, you know, mean and nasty. So it's that kind of Lennon versus Lenin split is going to potentially affect what happens to Jeremy Corbyn.
Just very quickly, let's just touch on this extraordinary story of Munro Bergdorf, the trans model sacked by L'Oreal for posting things on social media which appeared to be racist and homophobic, hired by the Labour Party to advise them on equalities. More and more stuff came out about things that she'd said before, including in the Times at the weekend. She's now just resigned. This strikes me as an absolutely mad story, which shows one of the problems the Labour Party has. I'll start with you, Matt. I mean, the thing I can't get my head around is normally somebody unknown is hired into a job and it comes out afterwards that they've said some mad stuff online. That was sort of why she was hired.
I think you've got to be really careful to not judge people on their online past and to forgive people and let people move on and to get a broader range of people into politics. So I get all those pressures and all those very noble desires. But if you are standing to be the future government, you have to be highly professional in the people that you're hiring. And it shows a real lack of judgment to employ someone that's so recently said those things that are so severe. It's the same with the General Secretary row. The way people run the party is the way that they will run the country. And these sort of decisions will affect the sorts of people that are brought in to run government departments and the way in which the civil service is run and the way in which Downing Street is run. Now, do the public care as much as I do? Absolutely not. But that doesn't mean it doesn't matter. And it slightly worries me that if we are going to have Corbyn in Downing Street, a lot of good will come of it. But equally, this is the sort of stuff that really worries me.
There's Rachel. A kind of hierarchy of victimhood on the left, I think, where, I don't want to say this in the wrong way, but sort of transgender is more important than women, gay,
no,
or
I wrote
Jewish.
This in my
you
column on Saturday. I said, in the Labour top Trumps, being trans, Trumps being racist. And you know, that they felt that bringing in a trans model was more worthy to the Labour cause than necessarily what she'd said in the past.
Well, and that's a wider point that I think for some on the left, the battle over equality and class is more important than feminism. So people like Harriet Harman and the sort of feminists in the party are sidelined. They're seen as sort of almost fighting an irrelevant battle. Yeah. And similarly, that's what's used to justify anti-Semitism or turn a blind eye to anti-Semitism. Somehow it doesn't seem as important as other forms of racism. And then the bigger picture, I suppose, is this all seems so irrelevant to most people. You know, leaving aside the differences on the left or whatever, most people are worried about, are they going to have a job? Can their children go to a good school? Are the hospitals working? Are the trains running? They don't care about whether trans people can be on the all-women shortlist or whatever it is.
Yeah. And nor do they, I suspect, think, well, I wasn't sure about that Jeremy Corbyn, but now he's hired that model that L'Oreal sacked. Yeah. I'm right on board. In a second, we'll talk to Matt Ford about PMQs. We'll be back after this.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Times Web Box podcast. I'm joined by Henry Zeffman, Rachel Sylvester, and this is Matt Ford.
There are certain rules. If I'd have known you had a beard, I wouldn't have put this in. There are certain rules in life that are seen as universal, things on which we all agree. You can't trust men with beards.
Apart from Henry Zephyr.
Apart from Henry Zephyr. C'est la vie by Bewitched is the greatest pop song of all time, and the public hate Prime Minister's Questions. I love PMQs. Well, I used to. PMQs is now dreadful to watch, the equivalent of a boring 0-0 played out on a wet Tuesday night. Bring back Yarboo, Punch and Judy politics.
So we'll overlook the beard issue, because Henry's got a beard, Alex, our producer, has got a beard.
I'm sorry.
And I'm sure you don't include Jeremy Corbyn either in your suggestion that you can't trust him. So let's focus on PMQs. And you are absolutely right. I've been sitting and watching it in the press gallery for about 12 years, and I don't think it's ever been so rubbish.
It's got progressively worse. So Blair Haig, in my life, really was the highlight. That was the zenith of what PMQs could be. Gordon Brown then sort of chipped away at some of the joy. Brown Cameron wasn't great, but it was good enough. Cameron was really good at it, so it doesn't matter who he was against. There was always a bit, you know, Miliband was kind of comical in a way. Cameron Corbyn was too one-sided, and now this, you've got two people who don't enjoy it at all and aren't good at it. And as much as I love it as a piece of entertainment, it is a vital part of a vibrant democracy to have the elected leader of the country face not just scrutiny, but quite raucous scrutiny. And actually, I don't agree that the public hate it. And I hate it when politicians say, oh, it's rubbish, and then they go in there and join in with it. It's the only bit of Parliament that the public ever vaguely tune into. The rest of the parliamentary week is as dull as people want it to be. So when people say PMQ should be more reasoned, the rest of the week is like that, and no one watches it. Don't let them ruin that one bit. The sad truth is, actually, this is being ruined by two individuals in particular, Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn, who don't engage with it. I mean, Theresa May, Prime Minister's often accused of not answering questions, and it's a line she's used before. Jeremy Corbyn doesn't even ask them.
Yeah.
And Ed Miliband went through a period where he would just make a point rather than asking a question, because they get sucked into the tete-a-tete of it rather than actually thinking of how to use it. And when you... I mean, Haig was one of the greatest. He would set traps for weeks ahead. So he would... I remember him once, and I think he's written about it in his Telegraph column, he said he would ask a question on a week where there'd be no scandal. So it would just come out of a clear blue sky, and he'd get up and say, will the Prime Minister guarantee that if any member of his cabinet breaks the ministerial code, they will be fired immediately? And of course, there'd be no scandal. So Blair would just go over the top and say, well, of course, he's right. If anyone has breached the code, they didn't bring evidence, we will deal with it. And then he would just save that in a box until someone had. And like a year later, Haig would be able to get up and say, the Prime Minister on the 27th of June made a solemn vow to the country. And it was a great... Firstly, that's a really good way to hold someone to account, keep a government on its toes. And secondly, obviously, it is great entertainment. And PMQs for me is a great fusion of the very best bits of parliamentary democracy. It's raucous, it's funny, it's entertaining, it's a personal battle, and it's underpinned by that valuable scrutiny in a public realm. And for me, I'm heartbroken at the moment because it is currently dreadful.
When it was Cameron and Miliband or Brown, you'd sort of go, oh, that's the clip they want for the telly.
Ah, yeah. But now it's social media.
But they don't even do that. You're not even aware. You're right. Until you have particularly Jeremy Corbyn, all he's doing is just preaching to his Twitter followers.
Well, who'd you say? The Tories don't care about, you know, the unemployed, and the Prime Minister doesn't care about the country. And that will get clipped up and that goes online. It doesn't matter that the question was awful. It doesn't matter that it wasn't a question. And actually, in a way, he's making it work for him. So at least he's got a sort of view of, this has got a life beyond the four walls of the chamber. But as now a piece of drama, as now a piece of scrutiny...
But it's just turning into PR for Jeremy Corbyn rather than holding the Prime Minister account. What do you make of it, Rachel?
Well, it's a test of leadership, isn't it? And the two leaders are both hopeless. So no wonder it's a disaster. Yeah. You know, and it's for different reasons. Jeremy Corbyn at one point subcontracted the questions, didn't he, to members
That's
of
right.
the public. It was,
crowdsourced
you know, Doreen from...
Derby, or whatever.
Yeah. Would set the questions and then he'd ask them of the Prime Minister. But Matt's absolutely right. It's a crucial way for the Prime Minister to be held to account. The other thing I think is interesting is the dynamic between those two leaders and their backbenchers. So the one of the purposes of PMQs is for Prime Ministers and leaders of the opposition to sort of set the political tone at Westminster. But in this case, you've got two leaders, neither of whom are respected by the MPs sitting behind them. So it's normally they're kind of trying to rally their troops. But in this case, Theresa May half her troops or more actually want to get rid of her as leader. And Jeremy Corbyn, majority of his have tried to get rid of him as leader. So it's a kind of weird atmosphere.
And as a result, the atmosphere is weird. The noise isn't what it was. Both of them can sit down at times, this sort of... You're not even quite sure which side that's come from. Yeah. Is that sort of...
There used to be a frisson. You talk to Cameron or one of the, they would talk about a wall of noise as you stood up, and there'd be a frisson to that, and that's not the same.
What do you make of any? Does this really matter? Is it not just political wonks like us?
No, I agree. I agree entirely with Matt that it is the only bit of the parliamentary calendar that does matter. Can I throw a third culprit into the mix for the decline of PMQs? John Bercow.
No!
For two reasons. One is that...
Men with beards.
I didn't realise it was a meeting of Bercow ultras. For two reasons. One is that he is responsible for policing the exchanges between the two leaders.
Yeah.
Jeremy Corbyn's questions, or questions such as they are partly rubbish because they go on forever. And ever and ever and ever and ever. And it takes him 2.5 minutes to get to a point. And by the time he's got to the sort of inflection which represents a question mark, Theresa May has quite understandably forgotten what the question started off as being. The second point, and it's related, is time in general. PMQs lasts forever. I mean, it goes on... And this is partly my complaint because I have to sit through it and the signal is rubbish, so I can't even scroll Twitter. I actually have to listen to this. Occasional wisecracks from Matt in my ear. The backbenchers element of it is important, and to John Bercow's credit, that is the major development of his 9 years as Speaker of the Commons, is that backbenchers are far more important, have far more of a say in urgent questions and calling ministers to account and all of that. And that's great. But he should extend that responsibility to policing nonsense questions from, you know, MPs who you've never heard of from somewhere talking about a youth centre, or not even that, youth centre are important, a garden centre. You know, would the Prime Minister join me in congratulating, you know, Wenlock Garden Centre
on
its great tulip crop? And Theresa May will say, yes, I do, and by the way, you know, we're going to make Brexit a success. It's just stultifyingly dull. You know, if we could cut that out and sharpen Corbyn's questions and May's answers, for that matter, up, the whole thing could be over in 30 minutes, and at least then it would be short and rubbish rather than long.
Do you think, conversely, select committees have got more important?
Yes,
sorry, absolutely. This sounds boring, but they are really now holding departments to account, and they're challenging elites, whether that's business, ministers, the prime minister, and they are really working. It's partly because they're elected now, the chairs, aren't they?
But I also think on the big issues of the day, and Brexit being the most obvious one, David Davis can get through Brexit questions in the Commons just by getting up and saying, oh, cheer up, it's all going to be all right, and sitting down again in another question, cheer up, it's all going to be all right.
But the Select Committee,
Can't do that. And actually, he's got in, the big pickles he's got in have been during Select Committee hearings, where he's sort of said that some impact assessments existed and they didn't, and they were very detailed, but actually they...
Excruciating detail was the phrase.
But then they didn't exist at all.
No, just excruciating.
The committee which struggles to hold its minister, its relevant minister to account, is the liaison committee, which is the committee of chairmen and chairwomen of other select committees, which gets to talk to the Prime Minister 3 or 4 times a year. And that is just a terrible forum for scrutinising the Prime Minister, because, as we all know, the best way of doing it is having a leader of the opposition who asks short, sharp, precise questions, 6 of them, once a week, and the problem is it doesn't happen.
Well, I think we've sorted everything out there. We've solved Brexit, we've sorted out the Labour Party, and we've come up with a plan for rescuing PMQs. That's all we've got time for this week, I think. Remember to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or on your Android device, and sign up to my daily morning email at thetimes.co.uk/redbox, and sign up to the Brexit briefing at home.thetimes.co.uk/mynews. Before we go, Matt, you've got a couple more episodes left of Unspun on Dave. When's it on?
That's right. Every Sunday at 10... Okay, I almost forgot. Sundays at 10 on Dave. Up-to-the-minute political comedy.
And it is very good. I went and saw it being recorded the other night. But for now, from Rachel Sylvester, Henry Zeffman, Matt Ford and me, Matt Cholley, it's goodbye.
Thank you for downloading. To discover more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.